Accession number 21564, Reel 22.
Colonel Cormac, Reel 22. You're mentioning the Russian approach to the use of personnel carriers.
Yes, they tended to have the combination of taxiing troops to a certain point, and then, as far as we could see in our limited opportunity, debussing, and then they went forward. But they were followed up by the armored personnel carriers. And the later ones, like the BTR-60P, did have a weapon, a small arms weapon, that could actually give some support. So they'd had that before we did. Ours were mainly tracked at that stage, although I think some wheel ones came in later. It's often difficult to remember the exact sequence of names and things after this time. But that was the thing. Mm. Should we just taxi up safely and then send them forward? Or should we take them closer and use the better weapons that were available in turrets on these vehicles? To give them support to get in. And as I say, it was more and more tending to get them further forward. At that stage, the self-propelled artillery was, of course, developing, and more and more in that field, the towed guns, were not so quite so good for the BOR. And allied to all that, and from the sapper point of view, was the question of gap crossing. Because BOR has a tremendous number of rivers of various sizes, which generally seem to run roughly north-south, right across the front for both people. And there was a continuing emphasis on how we could get armored vehicles across, and other troops, across river gaps or water gaps. And we studied both what the Soviet Army could do, what equipment they had, and how they would progress, and then we had to do the same. And we had all sorts of amphibious gadgets that we would button on or have on our armored vehicles to enable them to swim. Because the emphasis would be get as many across on bridges as you can, either dry bridges or amphibious floating bridges. Or if that wasn't possible, can you get your APCs down into the water, swimming across and out the other side, which would give you greater tactical flexibility? You wouldn't be tied to obvious river crossing sites with hardcore approach to a bridge, hardcore exits so that you could get your wheeled and tracked vehicles across. And all sorts of gadgets were there to help applique fittings to help vehicles cross, from screens that you could lift up, flotation screens.
Sounds rather like the duplex drive tanks used in 1944.
Not so very different from that. And then you had hub winches, which you could use with cables to winch them across in the shortest way. Otherwise, on their own power, they would have to go downstream, and they would inevitably land way downstream. Sort of the hub winches and cables would effectively get you across on the narrow thing, provided, of course, you could anchor them
on the far side.
And then other vehicles came along with anchors that you could, rocket-propelled anchors. And our combat engineer tractor, for example, which came in somewhat later, that had one of those, which meant that you could fire it onto the bank and then haul yourself out in the shortest possible way. That was very efficient, if rather noisy and quite frightening when it set off. But that was a development of the old rocket-propelled Holdfast we used in Korea, for example. And all these things were coming along, and fashions changed a lot. Should we go for a flotation like that and get and have masses of APCs lined up on the bank, all going across, or do you channel them onto a bridge site and get them across more quickly and safely that way, and yet be vulnerable to enemy interdiction.
Well, in particular, you'd be vulnerable to artillery fire or airstrike, wouldn't you, if you were relying on a bridge?
That's right. And then, at the same time as all this was going on, there was the idea of a bridge that you could make up in from different disparate parts. Again, one has to go back to the Soviet Army, and they had their PMP, which was not quite the same, but that could motor up in column to a riverbank. You launched all the pontoons, then they were linked together. You shot your stuff across, and then you disbanded it, and then winched them back on the trucks and drove away. The Americans followed that one up with the ribbon bridge. The British and the French and the Germans went to a different way, whereas the bridging unit as such would motor on its own. Instead of launching it from the truck into the water, you actually drove the whole truck into the water, and then you opened out your bridge and formed an instant raft, or you quickly linked it up because into a bridge. The French had developed one with pneumatic air support bags called the Gilois, which was very effective, but they tended to be vulnerable.
Presumably they could be punctured. And
that's right.
And they would lose flotation, wouldn't they?
They could do it. It would take a bit of time, but they were vulnerable to that. And they were less easy to maneuver once in the water. But that was an early one.
What sort of conditions could the power draft cope with them? Because this would be, wouldn't it, two amphibious trucks with special attachments to make a raft.
Well, one on its own would make a raft for one vehicle.
Yes.
The usual thing was to put two in and link them
together,
up
together. Yes.
And then your capacity was increased. And the German produced an all metal one, which didn't have the same. It was vulnerable, but not so vulnerable as the Gilles were, and it was easier to motor along. And once you got it in the water, it was ready. You didn't have to pump up the rubber pontoons, as it were, because they couldn't travel blown up. They were too cumbersome. And so we had a few on trial, and then we dropped them in favour of the German M2, which some years later became the M3, a more sophisticated version, easier to manoeuvre.
Again, when you were doing your exercises with the courses at Warminster, were you putting these new applications of armoured personnel carriers and motorisation into practice?
Well, certainly the river crossing ones we couldn't do because there weren't any.
You hadn't got a river to cross.
We hadn't got a river to cross. So those were just ideas that were being developed theoretically, and the equipment was being built by the various ordnance factories and research organisations, like MEXI at Christchurch was involved in that. It wasn't until I went to Germany that I was able to put these ideas into practice and saw them being. And then again, the idea of how to use these equipments. The important thing in Germany was the movement of troops. By and large, you were tied to roads. In wartime, it would have been slightly different. We could have gone across country, but damage control was always a major financial constraint there. But even so, tactically, you were confined to the good quality roads, of which there were a fair number in Northwest Europe. And then you had to work out, as always, your order of march. And that was one of the things that concerned me when I went to BOR. I was sitting at brigade headquarters because we got the sappers in with the gunner and the signaller. And then when we were planning to move on an exercise and a river crossing was involved, it was of considerable importance to get the order of march right, to have areas on where you could put certain units to the side safely to allow others through, and the priority. And so I had to, one of my business with the brigade major, in the brigade headquarters, was to make sure that the bridging equipment was sufficiently far forward to be operationally useful and also to be safe and secure. So you could balance that out. Mm. And everyone was anxious to get as far forward as they could. But that had to be controlled sensibly, but that's what we did.
But presumably you would have to have some sort of advance guard to provide you with protection in case of an encounter.
That was always the thing, an advance to contact or whatever. But I was concerned mainly to make certain that the river crossing equipment that we were going to use was in the right place at the right time. And at that stage, following on from our work in Warminster, was that we had an option. We had a range of equipment, old and new, as it were. You would have, for a brigade, or say a divisional exercise, you would have at least three crossing points. One might be an old heavy ferry. One might be a pontoon bridge. Another might be rafting. Or it might be a swim crossing. So we incorporated all these in to see how they worked and how effective they were. It was the only way you could really be sure. You could go to a bridging exercise site and line all your APCs up and other vehicles and say, right, down is the water, cross it out under a controlled situation, and you would have a very good chance of success. But when it was an exercise, things were different. And it was important to work those out and see what the effects were and which was the most effective crossing, where the snags were, where the traffic control snags were, what happened if something broke down, and so on, all adding up. But it all stemmed from ideas that we developed at Warminster and those that were, they were all ongoing in BOR as well. They weren't just waiting for Warminster. They were doing the same thing, but the feedback from one to the other was always continuous.
How was that accomplished? Was this done by correspondence or by cross-posting or by personal contact?
Well, it was a bit of all three. You see, I was quite interesting. I had never been to BOR before I went to Warminster, apart from my spell in Berlin. What I did do was go out to BOR for a few weeks on a major exercise before I went to Warminster. And there I was quite fortunate. We were in 4 Division. We were trying out a new organization, and that is a light field engineer regiment with each brigade. Up till that point, there would be a field engineer regiment in the division. There would be an armored engineer squadron, and coming in were these amphibious engineer squadrons with the Gilwa and later the M2, M3. What was the best way to control those? Well, what the CRE decided, and consultation with all the others, of course, that he would keep under his hand the armored engineers, amphibious engineers, and the field support squadron, that the existing regiment would be split into 2. And one to each brigade of the 2 brigades in the division. And so I went out and the CRE ran as the whole thing. His second in command took one regiment of the new side, and I took the other, and we ran those in each brigade. Mm. And first of all, it gave me very first-hand experience of what went on in BOR, and secondly, it kept me up to date with the new ideas of organization and how things were done there. So that was very useful for me. So at least I went to Warminster with some idea of what happened in BOR.
Was this because 4th Division was experimenting with the idea of the brigade group at that stage?
That was the sort of idea. They were trying it out first on Rob Roy, it was exercised. And it was the case when I went to later to 1st Division that we were actually doing that. And we were constantly refining the organisation to make it most effective. So we had sappers available in each brigade, and that's why I was in brigade headquarters, because up till that time, the CRE's staff were at divisional headquarters, and there were no sappers at brigade headquarters. They had a gunner, the armoured CEO would be represented there. And it was during that period that the sappers came into what we call the cruciform. That was the four command APCs that ran the show with the brigade major. And I sat in with, I had my own little APC there, the gunners had one, and so on. And we all worked closely together.
Now, I think in some areas, at certain stages, there was an attempt to devolve things down even further and give a sort of sapper representation down at battalion level as opposed to brigade. Was that being discussed at the time?
Not really, and I don't honestly think that it ever worked. I think it was more economical. The minimum level you would have was a light regiment at brigade. Mm. That was modified and changed afterwards, of course. But that was the minimum level that you could concentrate enough sappers to be meaningful. If you dished them out, as they always used to say, in penny packets,
yes,
you lost the effectiveness of them. Mm. You lost control to a certain extent, and they were not so effective in these smaller packets. Mm. We always felt that way, whether it was a light regiment or whether it was the regiments controlled by the CRE at division. Mm. That was always a fundamental thought. The only time you had your sappers dotted around was when you were withdrawing and you had your demolitions. All of them, and you had your firing parties all around. That was when you had lots of people out waiting for the signal to blow. Otherwise, you concentrated them as best you could. And the light regiment, I always thought, was the most effective way of doing that.
When you were doing the attacks in daylight and attacks at night at the Warminster exercises, were the students on the courses, were they being moved around in armed personnel carriers?
Yes.
No. And how would they do an attack? Would they actually get onto the position, or would they debus and do
They would, at that time, they did what the general doctrine was.
Yes.
As we say, it evolved all the time. The students themselves, would often put ideas up.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be better if... Mm. We used the APCs. I mean, I had, on every exercise, I had my own control vehicle. Mm. The gunner and so on, we would have our own, and we would go out and take up our positions where we could control or umpire what we were doing. Mm. Or where we could comment on what they were doing and getting up to.
Yes.
There was no shortage of APCs. Mm. Of the 4-3-2 variety.
Yes. But when they were doing an assault, when they were doing an advanced contact and then an assault, how close would they get to the enemy position before they debust to do their final attack?
At that stage, we were just in the transition from the taxi stage to driving on.
Mm.
And the students had a lot to think about, because are we doing the right thing in the first place? Mm. But you had to make the important thing was you had to make sure that when you left your APCs, you knew where they were going to be, and where you could get them very quickly to come up with you for the next move. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Zulu muster, I think, was the phrase we used to use. Mm. Because at that stage, we didn't have APCs with the right weapons on top.
Ah. So they weren't really capable of driving onto the enemy position.
At that stage, they didn't have. The most we ever did was have one or two with a 3-inch mortar in them. To give some support, and that was again experimental.
Yes.
Inevitably, the tactics were determined by the sort of kit you had or expected to have. Mm. I mean, we were talking about what would happen when, I think it was at the Fox, came in with its 76, I think it's a 76 millimeter, I'm not sure now, but it was a very effective gun on top. What we would do when that was readily available. So you were always marching slightly ahead, anticipating what you would get and what its capabilities were, so that when it did arrive at units, you would have some doctrine to spread around, and they could operate to that.
Yeah. What about attacks at night? Were they did they differ significantly from attacks by day when you were using APCs?
Yes, you had to stop, I think, much further back, because at that stage the noise factor was considerable.
Yes.
A low noise at night is very deceptive.
Mm.
You had to think of that, and I think they tended to operate on foot for a bit longer at night.
So debus earlier and then do the final approach.
That sort of thing, yes. But it was changing. It's difficult to be absolutely categoric now. But what happened when I started, and then at the end, things were definitely changing.
How did the requirements for infantry armoured personnel carriers differ from those that you required in the sappers? Because presumably the sappers would need more kit, wouldn't they, to operate effectively?
The difficulty with us was having equipment that would keep up with the battle group.
Yes.
Up to the 70s, 80s, we always seemed to be lagging behind.
Mm.
And I'm thinking particularly of armoured engineers.
Yes.
Our combat engineers, even when I was in BOR, we had the 4-3-2.
What, they went in the standard infantry?
The standard one.
Yes.
And it was only modified for us to the extent that it had certain more racks and bins bolted on that you could put kit in.
Mm-hmm.
But the armoured engineers always struggled. We had the Churchill tank when the armour had the Centurion.
Yes.
When other tanks came in, then
Churchill would have, what, roughly half the speed of the Centurion?
About half the speed. And although it was a steady number, it hadn't got the same armour.
No.
It hadn't got the speed.
It had a very great capacity for crossing obstacles, though, didn't it? Or
it was useful, but slow and ponderous. Mm. It was very good. It had its arc when you drove it into the ditch and then opened up the arms onto either bank and then you just drove across and hoped you would get it out afterwards.
Yes.
And then you had your Avery with its dozer blade on the front and your spigot mortar to send the demolition charge, otherwise nicknamed the flying dustbin.
The petard,
The petard, which you might be hoist with. That sort of thing. And one always felt that you were the poor relations.
Mm-hmm.
When we got the Centurion, the others were on the Chieftain.
Yes.
And it took a lot of persuasion over many years to make sure that our armoured engineers were on the same tank as the armour, at the same facility as the self-propelled artillery. We got there in the end, but that was a slow battle. So, again, our thoughts and plans were always based on what we had got and how to make the use of that. The one striking breakthrough that came after BOR was the combat engineer tractor, when it was the first time that we got a vehicle, a combat engineer vehicle, that was designed for our purpose, that was as good as anybody else had. And we felt, and it was realized, that when we got this, we could operate in support of the battle group at the same speed, with the same protection and the same usefulness as all the other vehicles. And the armoured engineers on the Chieftain had their own bridge lane tanks and so on. We now felt that we were really able to keep up with the battle group in every sense of the word. But all that meant that our tactical thinking, our operation, was always hindered by what we actually had got. We were very good on standard things. We knew all about our engineering and combat, but we couldn't do it at the same speed. Then we got the mine laying train. It was a monstrous beast. That was towed by a tank, usually a Churchill, and then later on a Centurion, with a 3-ton, 4-ton truck behind it full of mines, followed by enormous mine plough and a chute. And it was a most cumbersome thing because, again, mines were thought to be essential in BOR for defence. We used that train at Warminster. Then slowly came in the bar mine there, a radical change from a mine shaped like that to one shaped like that.
Oblong mine rather than a round mine.
Because it would cover much more ground than a round one.
Mm.
It, Then they, I'm sort of rambling on a bit, we found there was an old signal cable laying trenching machine which would dig a narrow trench. And it seemed a sensible idea if we could adapt that so it could be towed by a 432, which would be stacked with mines, slide them down the same channel into the same furrow as the cable laying plough, and the two wheels at the back would fill it back in, that you could lay mines more effectively at a greater rate and meet the needs of BOR again. And that, again, improved our supporting capability very much.
Now, I'm presuming that if, you know, if this is the case, the sappers were always in vehicles that were slower than the armour, then the whole battle group would have to go at the same pace, because if they were depending upon you to clear a river passage or lay mines or presumably remove mines, then they'd have to have you there, wouldn't they?
Yes, and they had to adapt the sequence of events to allow for that, because they naturally didn't want to move at the slowest speed, they wanted to move at the best speed. So we were always having to improvise to catch up with what we'd got, if you like.
Yes, I mean, the only sensible thing to do is to have everyone moving at the same speed, isn't it?
Ideally, if
you're having all arms tactics, it's got to be like that.
And eventually, that's what we got to. But from the time I was in BOR in the 70s, it must have been the 80s or 90s before we had a range of vehicles that could match the rest of them. And I say our bridging equipment, the medium girder bridge, was very effective. It was modified, adapted, enlarged, and became very good. And then we now have an even better range of vehicle-mounted, crane-operated bridging equipment, which I've only seen films of. I haven't seen it myself, because long after my time, allowed us to do even better. Warminster to jump to BOR, which was, of course, my next move. After Warminster, then I went to Germany, to Nuremberg, to 2-1 Engineer Regiment.
Was that something you'd expected to do?
I thought it was almost inevitable that I would have to do at least one tour in BOR, as it then was. I thought I was extremely, perhaps lucky isn't the right word, to avoid serving in BOR all these years. But in the end, I enjoyed it very much.
Where was 21 Field Engineer Regiment based?
It was based in a town called Nuremberg am Weser. And it was halfway between 1st Divisional Headquarters at Verden, to the north, and Brigade Headquarters, that's 11 Armour Brigade, to the south at Minden, which meant we were very nicely placed to split our interest between the two, to our personal satisfaction, I think.
How long were you second in command of the regiment?
For over a year, and during that time I did settled in and did one major BOR exercise. Eternal Triangle was the first divisional one, and a lot of these trials with the squadron commanders on river crossing and the equipment for flotation, which was the theme of the period. Then we had the big exercise, and we were just settling down to the usual routine when a third of the regiment would go back to UK on courses for upgrading as tradesmen and qualification, which was always a great part of the training cycle, when the news came that we were going to Ireland. And not only going to Northern Ireland, we were going as infantry.
Had you had any premonition that might happen?
No, not really. It was just the beginning of the idea of rotating units around 70-71. As the garrison there wasn't big enough to cope, new units were posted in, and then the rule among units came. And